On the margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Becky Thompson. Becky Thompson is a poet, scholar, activist, and yogi. She is one of the editors of This Unruly Witness, June Jordan's Legacy. The book has just been released this month from Haymarket Books. How are you doing this morning, Becky?
Great. I'm such a fan of yours, Ethelbert, for decades now. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, good to see you. I want you to begin. First of all, congratulations on this book, because this was not easy to do. So talk about that. Just the fact that, you know, we're talking about this book. Did you ever think this day would come?
Well, you know, you've been with me on this book from the beginning, but I think it definitely faced some challenges. One of them was COVID. One of them was losing Lauren Muller, who was the visionary behind the book. Another is what it means to be writing about someone who is in another realm with someone who is now in another realm. And then the complications of publishing in general. But Haymarket has been an incredible location for this book, and I couldn't be happier.
Mm. For those of us who are listening this morning, Becky Thompson, and are not familiar with June Jordan, talk briefly about who June Jordan was and also what she meant to you as a person.
Well, there's many different ways to talk about June, but I would say she was a visionary and a poet and an essayist and an activist and a musician and always wanting to add another layer to her creative mind. She also was extremely brave. She took on the powers that be around Palestine way, way before a lot of other people did. And she set up a revolutionary blueprint for teaching poetry at UC Berkeley that continues to manifest itself in many different spaces in the world. And I'd also say that June had a sensibility about her that allowed people to come into her realm and be their best selves. And that definitely happened with this book, because there are so many internationally known authors, poets, activists in this book that really stepped up to the plate in sending in their work and then staying the course as we found the right place for it to be published.
Mm. Well, give us a personal account. You know, you gave us a sense of who June was. Now let's talk about what June means to Becky Thompson.
Yeah. So when June traveled to the next realm, I was asked to give one of the eulogies, and I went to write a paragraph as I thought was appropriate, and instead a poem came out, and a poem had not come out of my body in 20 years, and I'd only been teaching June's essays. So it was really the beginning of what has become a centerpiece of my life, because once that poem came out, and then I took a poetry workshop with Sonia Sanchez and with you and with others, I started to see that the poet had wanted to manifest in me for a really long time. So there's that. I believe that when June traveled, she threw out a thousand batons. Mm-hmm. And I, for whatever reasons, got one. And I was very interested in who are other people who are carrying her baton and how are they carrying it, which is some of why Lauren and I first talked about this book, is getting to that metaphor in people's lives.
Talk about the creation of this book. You've been talking, and we'll talk a little bit about Lauren Muller in a minute, but talk about this book, because many times people come through our lives. We don't remember them necessarily with a book.
Well, the book itself represents a real range of voices of people who are carrying that baton, and with such creativity and ingenuity. I guess I would say that about the book. And the traveling of the book was finding a place that could recognize its import, and Haymarket became that place, in part because they know that Poetry for the People needed to be re-released. And also Maya Marshall, she is like the editor that's described in the book about Toni Morrison. She has a holistic understanding of what it means to be an editor, which means taking a book that is 30,000 words over and helping to find its core. It means organizing book readings. It means connecting with me with people that I wouldn't have known. It means finding the money for food when we're having a celebration. That whole person way of being. And Maya also recognized that for me, this book is about relationships.
Well, you know, when you say relationships, I'm thinking that in the preface of this book written by Alexis Pauline Gums, she mentioned that this is not a book, but it's a reunion. What do you think that she meant by that?
Well, there was the reunion of so many people who came through the Poetry for the People program. Either they came as students or they came as professors and activists sharing their work. And then there's people who are doing activist work, and our vision was to have all of them connected. And you were, of course, instrumental from the beginning, because it was, for me, it was making phone calls to people whose work I admire and people I know well, and just immediately having them say, well, of course, I'll be part of this. That's been the tone and tenor of the work.
Talk about this title, this Unruly Witness. Why that title?
Well, Adrienne Torf actually found that title because we had another title that she already was using, and because we worked very closely together, this Unruly Witness became the exact right title, because June has been a witness in an unruly way. And we're playing on the word there, because rule as in, you know, rule books, as in blue books, as in she's breaking free of that. And the, you know, her essay on the problems of language in the democratic state is about how language gets stolen and how passive voice is part of that problem. So this unruly witness is to create an adjective that is also a noun and it's a verb. We wanted that bigness in the title. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking immediately when we think of witness, we just came through the celebration of his centennial. We think of James Baldwin talking about witness. And I always look at the fact that when we talk about witness, we're not talking about somebody who's simply an observer. Okay. But then I was interesting to notice that Baldwin, as he got older, moved from describing himself as a witness, but then started calling himself a poet. So you see the poet as witness. And I thought that that was a thing, because many times we forget that Baldwin was also a poet. And this whole movement in one's life where you start off maybe being an observer, becoming a witness, or then eventually becoming a poet. And I just like how those terms fit together.
You know, Nicholas Boggs does a brilliant job showing that in that most all of his information and analysis early on in the book comes from the letters. But increasingly toward the end of Baldwin's life, he is tapping into the poetry as he's drawing on the very essence of Baldwin by then. And some of those poems I have never even seen. I just love the depth of the research in that book is really stunning. And I've been reading it alongside this book coming out and thinking about how many people in this book also have that depth of understanding in the way they do their work in the world.
Well, you know, if you were to compare Nicholas Boggs' book, the new Baldwin biography that just came out, what you would see in terms of connection with this unruly witness, both of these books, Baldwin and June Jordan, are both emphasize the importance of love.
Yes, absolutely. Love as life force. And Alexis, you know, writes about that in the foreword. You know, her foreword really was an introduction at the same time. We didn't end up needing an introduction because her foreword, which is a definition of love, love is life force, speaks to that. Yes.
You know, and when I interviewed Alexis some time ago, and I felt that in talking to her, you know, there's definitely a strong spiritual feeling, sense that you gathered from her. And I looked at some of these writers, June, Alexis, and then I also come back to like Tony K. Bambara, you know, who, when you talk about June as a visionary, I always saw, like the Salt Eaters, you know, by, Tony Kaye Brown, as being that sort of visionary book. You're teaching, is there any other writers or people who you see as visionary that you say, okay, I want my students to know the work of so-and-so?
You mean as teachers?
No, as that you as a teacher would introduce your students to say, okay, I want you to read June Jordan because I think she's visionary. I want you to read, you know, Tony Kaye Brown because I think she's visionary.
Well, I mean, I teach a course on Black queer poets. So every single person in that course, I consider visionary because I cannot teach as many as I would want to. Mm-hmm. But certainly Essex Hemphill, I would put on that list. Pat Parker, I would put on the list, obviously Audre Lorde. And I would also, you know, I've taught you in poetry classes before. And one of the many things that you and June have in common is that you soften the audience first with humor, with, you know, twinkle in the eye, with a light poem. And then you go in for the, okay. And there are 500,000 people who've been murdered in Iraq because of the U.S. military. That approach, that bigness that opens people's hearts, and then you know, you don't soften it anyway. And that, to me, is part of the visionary piece that comes.
You know, when you say that, I was always thinking of a couple of readings that June and I did together. Some people said, "Oh, you guys are just so silly," you know, because yeah. We were laughing and stuff. And I always felt that. Becky, one of the persons that influenced me in terms of humor and poetry was definitely Sterling Brown, you know, because when he was giving reading, you know, he would say, oh, in between these, you know, these poems or these lies, but the lies were so funny, you know, and when I think of June, I think of the Miss Funny Valentine poems, which are just hilarious.
Yeah. Okay.
But let's,
I don't know, but so maybe Ethelbert, maybe you read that, Miss Valentine.
No, I'm not going to read that. What we're going to do is we have a very important script that we have to follow. Okay. And I want you at this particular time, this book, The Unruly Witness, is dedicated to June Jordan as well as Lauren Muller. Lauren died in 2023. And she's one of the editors, along with you, Becky, and also Dominique Hill and Durrell Collier. I've read the bio that's in Lauren that's in the book, and I felt that must have been written by Becky. And I was wondering whether you could share that with our listeners.
Yeah, so when I had finished the editing of the book, I noticed that I had not done the Lauren Muller bio. And I'm someone who's pretty detailed, and I was, wow. And I realized that I hadn't done it in part because I needed to have more conversations with her sister and with her co-workers and beloved colleagues where she taught. And that, I think, also allowed for more resonance in the words, because they're really not my words. They were a channeling of the people who love her. Yeah. So shall I read that?
Mm-hmm.
Lauren Muller, 1959 to 2023. How to write a biographical sketch for someone who has traveled from this realm to another. Do you start at the beginning or the end? Shall we use her words or those who carry her with them now? Lauren was an early spring magnolia tree in bloom, a vulnerable, giving spirit who listened to the first panel of papers that became the nucleus of this book from her phone as she was getting a chemo treatment in San Francisco. Originally raised in Tennessee in Appalachia with her three sisters, Lauren was a transplant to Berkeley, the home of the Ohlone of the Verona Band, where she was a graduate student, taught poetry for the people, and eventually became the beloved chair of interdisciplinary studies at City College of San Francisco for over two decades. A sea at the turning of the tides, Lauren drew on energy around her to nurture her new courses and programs. Critical Middle Eastern Studies, Critical Pacific Island and Oceanic Studies, Trauma and Prevention and Recovery. Lauren co-edited Reckonings, Contemporary Social Short Fiction with Native American Women, and shepherded many people's poems into the wide world. From her broom closet office, she fashioned a workstation where her door and heart were always open. from her work as June Jordan's hand-chosen editor of the collectively inspired Poetry for the People, a revolutionary blueprint, to her accompanying June to chemo treatments and spreading June's ashes, to her vision for this collection, June and Lauren were family to each other. In her last letter, Lauren wrote, "June is with us in this project. I send you love and gratitude." On the day before she traveled, Lauren was still talking about the book, telling me, "Contact Joy Harjo. She wants to be part of it. Check in with Cornelius Eady." When an elder had asked Lauren which ancestor she wanted to guide her to the next realm, she said, "June is real close now." In the last hours of her life, Lauren's family read two Jordan poems to her, a poem about my rights and free flight. "Your flight is free, Lauren. The book is flying now."
Thank you. That was Becky Thompson reading the obituary for, well, the bio note, actually, for Lauren Muller that's in the book, The Unruly Witness, which is dedicated to her, to Lauren and June Jordan. Becky Thompson, you wrote an essay called The Waters Are Wide, We Can Cross Over. You say that's your favorite essay of June's. That's her essay, Many Rivers to Cross. There's a lot happening in that essay, and I want you to talk about it. I looked at it, and I looked at the Many Rivers Across, and I felt that there was this essay that was dealing with her father. Mm-hmm. It was dealing with her mother's suicide. It was dealing with raising her son. It was dealing with having an abortion. It was dealing with living one's own life. You know, those are the things when I looked at that essay. And then I went back. I think the song is like a Sam Cooke song, but I listened to it sung not by Jimmy Cliff. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I looked at Jimmy Cliff because of the Jamaican West Indian connection that when I'm listening to Jimmy Cliff, it's more powerful in terms of coming back to this essay. In terms of the title, you know, Many Rivers to Cross. I always play around with talking about, you know, June and the Jordan River, you know, the whole biblical connection. But when I heard Jimmy Cliff singing, you know, Many Rivers to Cross, it just moved me in another way that it was even different from Sam Cooke.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But talk about this essay and why it is you feel it's your favorite essay.
Well, Many Rivers to Cross starts with June talking about her mother trying to kill herself and actually succeeding. And we find out in order for June to get the insurance money. And I had someone close in my life who I love very much who had tried to kill herself. So in the first paragraph, I'm already, what? How do you have the audacity and the courage to write about? And when I was a graduate.
Let me stop you right there. Okay. I get this, and I said, you know, this is June. It's very serious, but it is funny because it's like saying, the essay begins, when my mother killed herself, I was looking for a job, but her father's like saying, go downstairs and check. And to me, there's something very West Indian about this. And it's sort of like, it's kind of funny. Like, oh, I'm going to go down and check to see if my mother's dead. What are you doing? I mean, I didn't want to read. It just sounded June funny. It's serious. It's devastating. But she has this sort of humor that sort of like a black humor. It's in there that you're looking at it and you say, okay, I know she's saying this, but it's comical. Like, you know, she's young and, what's she supposed to do?
Well, and she ends the essay with, she never wants to be in a situation where people don't know whether she is dead or alive.
Right.
She's saying, I want my mother to have been able to keep standing. And right. Her life's work is then so that people are very clear that someone is alive. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, speaks beautifully to Patricia Williams' concept about spirit murder. The spirit murder is not only killing someone's body, but also their spirit and the ways in which police brutality trades on the killing of a spirit. So June, yes, there's so much. I'm thinking about Jack Rogo in the volume, the experience of hearing June Jordan read, goosebumps, fireworks of laughter, mm-hmm. trying so hard to hold back the tears and then wiping them away. That was listening to June Jordan read her poems in person. It was a physical experience, unlike any other I've encountered in a lifetime as a writer and a fan of poetry. Now, Jack Rogo has been around a lot. For him to say he has never encountered that kind of humor, and certainly the West Indian piece comes out. Right. Yes.
So talk more about this essay and how you approached it in terms of as a activist and also as a teacher.
Well, what I write about in part is that there have been a number of quite tricky crossings in my life, and I have been aware that June's work and her personhood guided me on the crossings. I'm thinking, for example, of when I happened to be in Greece in Lesbos in 2015 at the very beginning of what became the biggest refugee crisis since World War II, where over a million people took little tiny rafts from Turkey to Lesbos in less than a year to that beautiful island. So I was teaching poetry in refugee centers and came to understand that who were the people who were assigned to me to be translators were professors in their own countries, one Afghan professor, for example, and that, of course, we needed to be co-teaching the class. And also, I was supposed to be teaching English. Well, why would I do that if people are coming and they speak Dari and they speak Farsi and they speak Arabic and they speak French? And if they're going to write poetry, it needs to come from the language that they were born and raised and loved to hear. So we had butcher paper all over, you know, the walls, and really people brought their children. And so we need to be sure to have, you know, food for kids and the cherries on the table. And that kind of experience is right out of June Jordan's life of creating. You create the art of teaching based on who is there in the room with you and the joy that is made possible because of that.
You know, in the beginning of this book, we have a quote from June in which she's saying that activism is not issue specific. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, Becky, especially this is 2025, yesterday we had elections, how do we avoid from placing ourselves in little boxes or silos? You know?
Well, we don't even have to avoid it because we now have someone who is the mayor of New York City who has refused little boxes since he was born, and his wife and his whole family and the 100,000 people that got up there to, you know, canvass. So little boxes, they're totally over. Well, they're gone, their history.
Right. Well, let's look at you. You're a teacher. We were talking about this before we went on the air. You know, you're a teacher and also an administrator. Many times, you know, a student comes to a campus and they say, okay, I'm going to major in chemistry or philosophy. Mm-hmm. You know, they pick up the book and they're fitting themselves into a little box. Okay. Sometimes they arrive on the campus. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be this. You know, I think for me, one of the reasons why I changed my major from history to Afro-American studies is that I didn't just want to be in the historical chamber. I wanted to know about literature and sociology and music and art. But many times that's not what happens when we go off to college, or that's not even in our household. We're raised to be in a little silo. You know, I look at my family, my sister got put in a nurse silo. You know, my brother tried to escape by going into the monastery, that silo. But what happens is that these are sometimes the choices that you have in a household, even before you get off to college.
Well, and I think the pressures that students feel so much to have a profession from right early because they're so worried about finances, right, is much, much worse than it used to be. We used to have some kinds of freedom. We also had Pell Grants. And I mean, I put myself through college and the PhD for sure, but I had access to some money through the scholarships that the students don't even have now. So I see their pressures. But, you know, when they come in and they want to be a nurse or a doctor, and then they learn that Rafael Campo gives poems as prescription, and then they see that they not only need to think about that they want to become a nurse, but why they want to become a nurse. And not only that, they're listening to someone's heart but what's going on in that person's heart in their families, that the heart is much bigger than the beat. And where are they going to get that? They're going to get that in African American studies. They'll get it in sociology. They'll get it in women's studies, right? They'll get a way for them to find their own dharma that is not necessarily their parents' wishes. Yes, mm-hmm. I watched this whole thing. And then I work with nursing students who are so pushed into their requirements to figure out ways so that they can find the spaces to be able to do a major in Africana studies, for example. Yeah.
Okay. Before we go to our break, Becky Thompson, I want to ask you a question. You put this book together. You're working with your fellow editors. What did this book teach you about love?
About love? Well, I mean, I've recently had big love come into my life. And I've been waiting for her for a really long time. So this, I can't separate finishing this book with that. But I'm also thinking about the people in the book that, like Naomi Shihab Nye, the woman, because I've gotten to work with her on other projects, has such a deep love for her father. And for olive trees and for young people and for justice. And she's, you know, the lead poem. I think about Elizabeth Alexander, her gorgeous essay about the Trayvon generation, where she's worried for and passionate about her sons and what their lives are like when they're being raised around police brutality. And I'm thinking about Adrian Torf, right? It began as a romance. The collaboration of June Jordan. Now that I want to, if we had time, wanted to read a little bit from Adrian's, because talk about a love poem. This book is also a lot about gossip. Seriously, you know, say that, but it's who's who and who is with and what love has to do with all of it, because these bed-based networks are so important to our multiple movements. So yeah, it's all about love, and it's helped me to be in that realm.
You see, I laugh at how you made reference to everybody in the book and stuff like that, even though the question I asked was to you.
About love? Well, no, my love has just gotten bigger and bigger for me.
Right. Yeah. Because you know what happens, on a serious note, Becky Thompson, you know, we work on these book projects, and sometimes we come across like an essay, we're rereading things, you're rereading poems, reading stuff, and then all of a sudden we like say, okay, something's connecting to me with me on this level that it was not there before.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. And then I feel that if you're going to complete this project, if you're going to get this, an anthology is difficult to pull together. It has to be something that keeps you up, that love that keeps you up in the middle of the night to say, I'm going to finish this.
Well, certainly the people who are in the volume, you know, yourself included, who kept checking on this book and wanted to be sure it was out in the world. But also June's spirit is a very big spirit she has. I mean, as is true for many people, but that pulls you forward. I'm just thinking before we go on break, the reference you made to the poem that we open it with. Activism is not issue specific. It's a moral posture that steady state propels you forward from one hard hour to the next. Believing that you can do something to make things better, you do something rather than nothing. You assume responsibility for the privilege of your abilities. You do whatever you can. You reach beyond yourself in your imagination and in your wish for understanding and for change. You admit the limitations of individual perspectives. You trust somebody else. You do not turn away. To me, that's the essence of love.
Okay.
You do not turn away.
That was Becky Thompson reading from June Jordan, from her essay on becoming a breast cancer activist. We're going to take a little break. You've been listening to Becky Thompson, who's a poet, scholar, and activist, and yogi. She is one of the editors of This Unruly Witness, June Jordan's Legacy. The show's on the margin. My name is Yethel Brett Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of November the 3rd, 2025. Thursday, November the 6th, from 7 to 9 p.m., Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars present the film Thomas Sankara, The Upright Man by Robin Sheffield, followed by a post-screening discussion with Paul Sankara, brother of Thomas Sankara, at 3222 11th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The film is a detailed history of Sankara's brief four-year rule and his revolutionary program for African self-reliance. Information at bloombars.com. On November the 8th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, located at 2714 Georgia Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., join author Nikisha Breeze in conversation with Professor Greg Thomas on A Mutiny of Mourning, followed by a special screening of Stages of Titanic Blackness. Return, remember. For more information, visit Sankofa.com. On November the 9th at 12:30 p.m., Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church, located at 4300 16th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., will hold the seminar Financial Strategies for Difficult Times. Speaker Marky Baker will lay out ideas and suggestions to help us get through the challenging financial times we are facing. For more information, reach out to scblume@gmail.com. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar hosts, helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Becky Thompson. We're talking about the new book, This Unruly Witness, June Joy's Legacy. I want to make people know that there will be a book party for this book on November 12th, that's next Wednesday, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Bus Boys, which is the Bus Boys located at 450 K Street. So make sure you go to the right Bus Boys. And on that evening, between 6 and 8, some of the people who are in this book who will be present will be Kelly Navies, Adrian Toff, Kathy Engel, Zain Azam, Ruth Foreman, Amy Horowitz. Before we went on a break, Becky, you wanted to cite something that Adrian wrote. So could you?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little taste of what Adrian will be talking about.
Sure. And of course, she's a consummate pianist. I've gotten to hear her a number of times this last year. It began as a romance, the collaboration of June Jordan and Adrian Toff. It began, of course, as a romance. So much of June's life was a romance. As a child, the romance with language, the romance of and with a young man in a yellow Oxford cloth shirt, leafleting, jacketless on a cold autumn day, the passionate romances with women and with men, the romance of Buck, her beloved Airedale, trotting along a beach in the winter, all things are dear that disappear, the romance from a distance and the romance up close, the romance with students occupying the sidewalk next to CNN or Sproul Plaza, delivering his poem, delivering his poem at the UC Regents annual meeting. The romance of a clean white shirt, of a tennis court, of a Volkswagen speeding toward home on a dark winter evening, of someone new, of someone gone, the romance of all life is possible, the romance that all love is possible as well. It began, of course, as a romance, one snowy April night in a theater in Minneapolis. June led off the program reading poems. I played piano for a singer, and June asked to meet me. In the green room, she explained, through dark glasses and a smoke of the slim brown Sherman, she explained, in her impeccably tailored mocha-colored wool suit, pearl gray silk blouse, matching hose and heels way too tall for walking in snow, she explained that others had set her poems to music. Leonard Bernstein, Roy Brown, Sweet Honey of the Rock. But this time she said she wanted the poem and the music to grow together, to be conceived and created in tandem, a real collaboration, she said, through the smoke and the shades and the echoes of poetry and music from the hall. And I said, yes, of course, wouldn't you? Yet there was nothing, of course, about it, this meeting or a collaboration between so powerfully gifted, controversial Black poet and a so naively gifted white piano player and composer. 19 years and the continent's breadth between us, we began.
Okay, that's right. And that's Becky Thompson reading Agent Toft's work in terms of her contribution. It began as a romance, the collaboration of June Jordan and Agent B. Toft. And so that's in this collection. You know, when we pick up this book, Becky Thompson, The Unruly Witness, June Jordan's Legacy, the book is divided into three sections. Was this based on the material that you received, or was you already dealing with how you were going to break this book down?
Well, poet on the world stage, of course, because June traveled to Nicaragua. She traveled all through Europe. She traveled to South Africa. She traveled to Palestine. She traveled to Watsonville after the earthquake to interview the people who were living at the epicenter of the, she was a traveler. And the world stage was her willingness to bring words, even if she was going to get blacklisted, which is really what happened in New York. So that opens the book because of that. Then We Are Lucky She Dared are many stories and examples of people who were really touched by June's work as teachers, as professors, as colleagues, as lovers, and yours is in there, right? Some of us did not die, which, you know, I people know that may know that there was just a beautiful review of this book in Salon magazine that Randall Horton wrote, and he lifted up your essay in there. And then part three, The Awesome Difficult Work of Love. Well, yeah, it is awesome. It's difficult. And many of the essays in there speak to the difficulty, the complexity of love. Yeah. So these essays kind of found their way into those sections because of the depth of her work.
Mm. You know, when we look at the depth of her work and we measure her life, I was thinking about what we had a recent conference here in D.C. on Sterling A. Brown. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that, you know, even though many people talk about Sterling Brown as this great poet, and especially in his book, Southern Rose, a classic, you know, Sterling Brown took really pride in the fact that he was a teacher for 40 years at Howard University. Mm-hmm. And when I look at this book and I look at June Jordan, it's almost because of Poetry for the People that June is almost known as a teacher, even more so than as a poet. And I think of the fact that also when she was living, she was always upset to the fact that she was being overlooked as an intellectual. You know, I think she was very proud of the essays that she was writing for the Progressive magazine on a regular basis.
Well, I insisted that there be an index in this book, even though it's not common to have an index in a collection, because she is a scholar. And, you know, we're going to be having, I could have had that one of the many celebrations for this book anywhere in P-Town, really, in Provincetown, but we're having it at the public library because there's, you know, whole walls of books to celebrate her as a scholar. And I agree with you completely that without, I can't imagine June Jordan without being a teacher. And she's willing to talk about how hard that work is. And some of the people in the book write about that as well. There's one story where, you know, she took such the hit around her positions and her belief in the right to Palestinian sovereignty. But she was lambasted by a few students who didn't think that she was standing up enough. And she took to her bed for a week about that. And I, mm-hmm. when I read that, I thought about how, because I come into teaching with my heart open and I bring books that can save people's lives, when I feel misunderstood or unrepresented or unseen in a way by a student, it's devastating for me still. And so, June's work helps me to figure out how to pick your heart up, especially if the heart has been hurt by people close to you.
Mm. When you say that, one of June Jordan's students who's included, the work is included in this book, is Elizabeth River Meyer. She's a trauma therapist, and her essay in the book is entitled Truth Telling is an Emancipatory Act, What June Jordan Taught Me About Liberation. And Meyer describes herself as a 52 old white Southern queer Jewish woman. You can see her June connecting to this person, but I just want to read something and have you respond to it. This is in, Becky, I want you to respond to Elizabeth River Meyer's essay where she writes, our instruction was to, and she's talking about the class that she took with June. Our instruction was to speak the unspeakable, possibly the undesirable, and always something authentic and of weight. This psychological and spiritual exercise in truth-telling morphed into two poetry classes the following semester, classes June taught in the African American and Women's Studies Department, and that were ultimately grounded in the formation of poetry for the people. Talk about the whole thing. I mean, you're able to speak about the unspeakable or possibly the undesirable, especially if you're coming out of trauma.
Yeah, so if there's any poem that has been, you know, cited the most of June Jordan's, and thankfully we do have one time example of her reading it herself, is a poem about my rights. And part of why I think that is such an extraordinary poem is that she's talking about trauma on multiple levels simultaneously, and her own healing from rape and her own healing from being misjudged and maligned as a black woman and as a feminist, all of that weaves in with her understanding that colonization also needs to be overthrown, that you can't separate any, you know, June was doing intersectional work before it was called that, when we referred to it as the simultaneity of oppressions. And for me, because I am also a trauma survivor, knowing that my own ability to be free in this world is completely connected to everybody else's right to freedom, that understanding comes right out of June Jordan. Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at poems from my right, in my archive, I have the original copy of it because I helped June edit that poem, actually. And we had some controversy about the poem, you know, and that I think actually you mentioned it because I quote an interview that, Carla Hammond did with June. And we got into this whole thing about why is June's father in the poem and so on. But what happened is when she read this poem for the first time, it was at Howard University at one of the writers' conference. Mm-hmm. And when she gets up and says that she was raped, there is a hush that goes through the entire audience. And what we have to look at, we talk about, you know, writer's witness. I think what happens here is something that we don't see enough of. Courage. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, what that act of June's, for many people who knew her, who there, you know, have, you know, who are there, is at a conference. She is willing to say, okay, this is what happens to me. I'm going to be a witness to this. But the courage that it took, you know, I mean, I know a number of women is that, you know, that is something that they just don't want to talk about again.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then I think she takes it to the world stage because she talks about what happens when South Africa rapes, you know, the nearby country. So right. You begin to see what she's doing, but it's the courage that it took, you know, many times for us, we're reluctant to sort of say, well, maybe it takes a certain courage to go down to see whether your mother's dead, you know? I mean, so that's a courage as a young person. But this is the thing that I find that many times we don't see our politicians having the courage to speak up. Mm-hmm. We don't see sometime a person willing to defend a project that might be on the target. You know, the people are silent. A faculty member might be silent as a whole department is erased.
Well, I remember when June came and was reading from Soldier, and which was her, you know, final work. And she had told me that it was the hardest book of all of the books that she did. She also had 250 pages that she had to put aside and start over in order to find that child's voice, right? That book is dedicated to her father. So she both is naming her father and his abuse of her when he's waking her up in the middle of the night with a baseball bat so she'll learn how to be a soldier, but also dedicating the book, that helps us understand that it's not simple about this healing process. And so I understand why she put him in that poem, because when I do show that poem to students and their mouths drop and they can't believe the complexity, what really gets them is when she's talking about when her father did not feel comfortable being on campus.
Right.
I work with, 50% are first gen students, 60% are trans students or students of color and students of color, right? They get it when they can't even bring their families to campus, or the people that I work with who work in the dining halls, who don't even have access to the library. That level of exclusion is part of that bigger piece. So yahoo that she put that piece in.
And, I think that when we talk about that, sometimes it is race, but then it's also class, that are people just feel, okay, I'm stepping onto this, this campus, which is far from my community. Yeah. When we're getting towards the end of our show, Becky Thompson, and there's a big question that this book sort of raises, and that is, what do you believe is June Jordan's legacy?
Well, I'm so glad that you've highlighted her being a teacher and the decades of teaching that she did. I think when you name courage, I was thinking about, you asked Kazim Ali in an interview you did with them about, why do we lift up June's name even more, Audrey's name even more, since they've gone? And I think that one of the things they have in common is that courage to speak up at points when it wasn't convenient and they might have been laughed off the stage or they might have been shamed, to push through that shame. I think that's gonna stay. And I'm hoping that this book is one of the many. This is the first book that's from a multiple perspectives on June Jorgens. I'm hoping there will be other books that speak to this as well. But her legacy lives inside of so many people that is gonna stay with us. We're gonna, there's poetry, there's a Busboys and Poets, but there's also, a celebration we're going to have in Jamaica Plain, where I live, in Boston, and also in Provincetown, and also at the Howard Zinn Book Fair in San Francisco, and also at Lincoln Center, and also in Puerto Rico, and we're going to have something Zoom on two different, time zones, so that people in Gaza and people in Cuba who you have connections with will be part of it. And that itself, the people are gonna keep, it's poetry for the people, as Mandani is also talking about, will continue this legacy. Yes.
What does it mean? What does it mean to be a poet of the people in 2025?
Courage.
Okay. Well, then the other question that this book, I think, opens the door to is, how do we pursue the politics of solidarity?
Well, that's one of the most beautiful gifts that June Jordan gave us, was understanding that people's trauma is not what will link them on the other side of it. Solidarity comes from finding what bonds us together in terms of our survival and thriving. And those bonds are not, they don't necessarily follow class and race and gender lines. That's her piece in About Olive, Report from the Bahamas, when she's saying, I'm there in the Bahamas, I'm staying at a fancy hotel, and Olive, who's cleaning my room, might want to have nothing to do with me, actually, because of the differences in class and language and culture. So these alliances are not simple, and certainly for myself, that I live, I have a multiracial family and have taught Africana studies for years, it opens up spaces that are not what people might expect. Yeah, so all of that, I think, will keep living.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I try to do, at least in my contribution to this book, this essay, Some of Us Did Not Die, Remembering June Jordan, I looked at her work and I broke it down into these 9 categories, Becky. One, the Middle East. 2, Black Studies and Black English. 3, the fight against cancer. 4, prison and police violence. 5, international affairs. 6, bisexuality. 7, New York, and specifically Harlem and Brooklyn. 8, love poems. And 9, humor. Do you agree with that? Do you see? I mean, I did that. And my question to you, I mean, I've listed those 9 categories. If you looked at that, which one is the most important to you that you think when you look at, you know, you're examining June's work and you say, okay, we're going to begin with this?
Well, you know, I'm not going to like to choose that. Right. And I'm so glad that Randall Horton lifted up those categories in his Salon review. But for me right now, Middle East would be it, because the genocide of Palestinian people is so deeply connected to the genocide of Native people in the U.S. that has never been fully reckoned with, that I want to have as many teachers and prophets and activists around me as possible for us to be sure that the gardens in Palestine live.
You know, I'm glad that you said that, because I thought that that would be the answer that you would probably say. For me, I look at her battle against breast cancer. Even the quote that's in the beginning of the book is from one of her essays dealing with breast cancer. It is when you look at how June has this thing like what is breast cancer? You know, she has this thing that she's like, okay, I've been diagnosed. Her whole approach, I think, is very, very instructional. I want to find out as much about this as possible. To me, when we talk about, okay, somebody wanting to be a writer, or somebody wants to be the ability of seeing, okay, the hard work that is necessary, before you go out and do the open mic, okay, you prepare yourself where you know the tradition. I want to know everything about cancer that I can find. And to me, that's very instructional, because I think she takes that approach to when she say, okay, I'm going to read up about Bosnia. Okay. Or I'm going to read about South Africa. Or I'm going to sit down and do collaboration with Buckminster Fuller. There is a rigor that she brings in to her work. And I think that's what's instructional. So if I was teaching, I would say, okay, here's a very personal, because we begin to see how June takes the personal, makes it political, as well as the political being personal.
Yeah. Well, and that's a fabulous example too, about how her survival was so interlaced with the community of people around her. So Angela Davis, at that point, did all of her research, because she is a consummate scholar, so that they had as much information as possible. And of course, you know, with HIV, when it was clear that gay men could not rely upon the medical establishment for any help, it was the lesbians, the feminists, who said, you gotta do your work yourself. And that's what came out of the research on breast cancer, right? So there was Angela Davis right there doing the research. There were students who were showing up at her house unannounced, to be sure. So that, and there was Lauren. There was so many, this, how do you wrap around people in a crisis? And she was, because she had done all of her homework as a friend and an activist and a scholar, she had that too to draw on in the process. Yes.
You know, I know people make connections. And I was thinking, as you were talking, there's one person that, I met a couple of times, but to me had that sort of mystic, was Susan Sontag. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've always looked at the fact of, we think of Adrienne Rich, you know, we think of other people, we think of Toni Morrison, you know, but I always think of that, you know, the intellectual, you know, and that was something that I feel that, you know, June should be seen that way, where her ideas are just as important as some of her poems and her humor.
That's a beautiful connection too, because Illness as Metaphor is such a slim book.
Right.
But it could be the book to teach in a medical sociology course or in a public health course, because it was such a distillation of her scholarship and in a poetic kind of way. And that's what June did as well. Distilled whole because of her research.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so Becky Thompson, this comes to the end of our program. What I want to remind people that next week we'll be celebrating this book at 450 K Street, Bus Boys and Poets at 450 K Street Northwest on November 12th from between the hours of 6 to 8 p.m. So you could pick up a copy of the book that we have been talking about, This Unruly Witness, June Joy's Legacy. Becky Thompson, it's always wonderful to talk with you. I'm always learning from you, and I wish that you much success in terms of the next project that you'll be doing. Okay. She holds up her hand. My guest today has been Becky Thompson. She's one of the editors of This Unruly Witness, June Joy's Legacy. She's also an activist and teaching with Emerson, right?
Teaching what?
Teaching at Emerson.
No, Simmons University.
Simmons University.
That's okay. Many other places I've taught as well.
Up there, right. Okay. So I want to thank you very much for being my guest on The Margin. The show is On The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
The soul of West Africa lands at Brentwood Arts Exchange's Listening Room on Friday, November 7th at 8 p.m. with Chek Amala Jabate, a master of the Ngori, the traditional West African lute. Jabate weaves stories through rhythm and song, blending ancient sounds with a modern spirit that moves both heart and feet. Details at pgparks.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org. Make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
The Capital Area Food Bank is offering free food distribution for federal workers starting now until the government reopens. Federal employees and contractors will need to show a government work ID to receive food. Distribution times and sites are as follows. Tuesdays, 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. at No Limits Outreach Ministries, 7721 Barlow Road, Hyattsville, Maryland. Wednesdays, 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at So What Else, 6116 Executive Boulevard, North Bethesda, Maryland. Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at United Community, 7511 Fordston Road, Alexandria, Virginia. Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at Urban Outreach, 5343 C Street Southeast, Washington, D.C. Saturdays, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Linda Benn Foundation, 10739 Tucker Street, Beltsville, Maryland. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Thank you, family, for standing with WPFW during our fall drive. Because of your support, we shared powerful moments. The No Kings protest, the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March, and a moving all-day broadcast on the struggles in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listeners in the Congo downloaded our radio app
tuned in and sent us messages of gratitude, proof that your generosity connects people around the world. We came within $30,000 of our goal. If you are able, please help us close the gap and keep WPFW strong. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org, where you can donate or get our P.O. Box number of where to send checks. WPFW, Jazz and Justice, people-powered radio, connecting our communities globally while building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you ready? The Birchmere presents Najee, November 8th. The Manhattans featuring Gerald Alston, November 29th, and Take 6, December 4th. Details at birchmere.com.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.